Session number 9963.
Mr. Brewer, reel 9.
That chap has got to adjust his sights and his line. And while he's doing that, I said we can move a few yards forward. So we did this, and we beat him because he was up and down and we were in between all the time. And I, just before we came to the crest, I looked to my right and I could see a chap walking up the hill. And it was time for the next burst of fire, so I shouted, "Get down, man." And he ignored me. Well, I got these chaps over the crest now and went to Fletcher and said, "Our machine gun had been knocked out." And I said, "Have we got any rifles here?" "Oh, damn, no," he said, "we've only got one." And I told him what had happened. And I asked him now, "Did such and such a fellow," he was a Welsh Spaniard, "has he so reported to you?" "No," he said, "I haven't seen him." "Oh, hell," I said, he's bought it. He'd obviously run from the front line trenches and he was bringing back a message, I assumed. And I said, "We'll have to go and find him." So I said to my gun team, "Right, I want 4 volunteers." And I said, "Now we're going over. We're going to find him. He's probably wounded if he isn't dead. If he's wounded, then I do what I can with my knowledge of first aid and we'll get him out." And I said, "We don't stop for anything. We've got to take the chance." Well, we got down to him and he had a compound fracture of the thigh. The bullets had hit him and severed the artery. So I put a tourniquet on it. We got a bit of cloth from somewhere and stopped the bleeding. And I said, "Now I'll hold on to his feet, so I got to keep them together. You'll hold on to his knees and keep his legs straight, and you two can take his shoulders." So we got him up. And now he was too dazed. He was coming and going. And to give Fletcher any information. So George turned to me and he said, "Well, will you get him back to the first aid post, Jim?" And I said, "Where is it?" "Well, somewhere back along that ridge," he said. "Okay," I said, "we'll find it." And I said, "Can I have that rifle now to act as a splint?" Because I said, "These 2 feet have got to be kept together and this leg has got to be rigid." "Aye, okay," he said. So we dealt with him as well as we could. We got hold of a bandage from somewhere to put over the wound. And off we went. And we'd gone about 50 yards along this ridge and down came a squadron of Heinkels. And they plastered this area with small bombs. Well, I heard them coming and I said, "Right, lower him." I stayed with him and I told him, "Now scatter." And they scattered about. And these damn bombs, small bombs, came down. And miraculously, not one of us was hit. But you could see the weight of armament they had, that one small party obviously carrying a wounded man was a target. Anything that moved was a target. And they could afford to waste petrol, machine gun bullets and all the rest of it to inhibit any movement on the battlefield. And that day we got him to the dressing station and the chap who I told you I'd evacuated from the Battle of Brunetti was in the gun team. And when we got back, now we were going back about 500 yards, I said, "Where's so-and-so?" "Oh God," they said, "we haven't seen him." And last year I discovered that he'd stayed with Alan Menai Williams at the first aid post. He wasn't going to go back to the front line. He'd had an hour of it and that was enough. And he's tried to make himself out a hero since, but he's been quietly told to shut up or we'd start talking. And then, of course, this parade came off. We were treated with great respect on that day in Barcelona. Then we went back to our billets and got ready for our departure. We marched across the border, Guard of Honour, French soldiers, Guard of Honour, Spanish, who presented arms as we walked by. And we got to this French railway station now, and there was a buffet. And we went for that like a horde of wolves. Bought these long, fresh bread, French bread efforts. Got our knives out, cut it along, bought some butter and some soft Gruyere cheese. There we were now, putting the butter on and so on. And we cut it then. And we started eating. And we managed, I think, about four pieces. We couldn't eat any more. Our stomachs couldn't cope with it because we'd been on a very low ration, the civilian ration that the Spaniards had for the past 5 weeks. And we wondered how the hell they could live. And then we felt ashamed that we had given way to greed and gone and had this food. And we failed, absolutely failed, to eat that bread. Now, we got onto this seal train, which rushed us through France. We stopped at one big station, and I think we were guilty there of a bit of bad manners, because the Red Cross had turned up with mugs of coffee, mugs of cocoa for us, and bread. And we couldn't stand it. And we said, there are children in Spain and women who are starving. Please take it there. And we refused it. Then we got off, we got to the port, got onto one of the ferries and arrived at Victoria Station to a fantastic reception. There were thousands of people out there, including Ted Heath, who I think Ted was a supporter of the Republic. I certainly didn't want the fascists to get away with it. And then, of course, there were all sorts of people turning up then who had left Spain before us for one reason or another, and there was a grand reunion. And subsequently then we had a memorial meeting in the Empress Hall, and I had the privilege again of carrying the battalion banner and led all the banners of all the nations down into the arena. The only trouble was now there were so damn many banners there that everything lost significance, and my only duty now was to lower the flag in salute when they played the last post. But I had to stay there all the time while all these speeches are made and all the rest of it. Oh, God. And I was glad all the ceremonial was over to retire into civilian life.
Did you ever have any discrimination against you because of having fought in Spain?
No. When we met Brigadier General Molesworth, who was a British representative on the non-intervention committee, he asked me, what are you going to do now? And I said, well, I hope I'm going to enjoy the next 8 months or so. And then I said, I'll be under arms again. Oh, how do you make that out? Well, I said, if there's any guts left in Britain and any knowledge of the peril they face, we shall be at war in September of 1939. And I said, if they'll have me, I'll be volunteering.
How did you come to go before the non-intervention people?
Well, they were taking our names, you see, and home addresses and so on. There was a Finnish general General Molesworth and someone else, who were, it was their responsibility to the non-intervention committee to give them our names, ranks and number. And Molesworth was a very courteous old chap, very fit-looking man. And he was really, he was taken aback, you know. And he said, "Do you really believe that?" "As sure as I breathe," I said. "And you ought to know," I said, "you're a professional soldier. I'm a novice." He's really intrigued, because we were only supposed to give him our name, rank and number. But so far as I was concerned, he was indirectly a representative of the British government and entitled to know what I thought about the situation. And I got a job then, but very badly paid, of running the these camps, which had been going now every summer, with the combination of the South Wales Miners Federation and the university labour clubs, Oxford and Cambridge notably. And so I had a camp in West Wales, and there was a house up in Abergavenny where we used to entertain pensioners for a week at a time. We'd have women in 1 week and men in the next, and give them as good a time as we could. Well, then, of course, the declaration of war, the lugubrious declaration of war on September the 3rd, was it, by Chamberlain?
Yes.
Like a funeral oration rather than a call to arms. And a couple of days afterwards, an army lorry drove up, and a major got out and came in looking for me, and he said he was the billeting officer of one of the Welsh brigades. And I said, "Well, this is," and I'd seen now the artillery, some of the artillery regiments going by down towards Newport, ready. And I said, this house would make an ideal brigade headquarters. Certainly all right for a battalion. And I said, "I'm leaving this job as soon as I can to join up, so I'm trying to wind it all up within the next fortnight." But I said, "Well, there you are, it's open to you." And I said, "Now, one thing, the man who owns this was a conscientious objector in the First World War." And I said, "He'll screw the army for everything he can." Now, I said, "He's on the side of the profit makers. And we are getting it," I said. "He's very kind, because we're looking after the building for him for a peppercorn rent." "Oh," I said, "well, that's useful information." So he said, "Well, have you been a soldier? You've been in the British Army?" I said, "No." Well, he said, "You seem to have got some military ideas." And I said, "Yes, well, I've met our current enemies," I said, "for the past 2 years out in Spain." "Oh," he said, "that's interesting." And I said, I prophesied that that we'd be at war within the first week of September of this year to a high-ranking British Army officer in Spain. I said, "And here it is. We should have been at war, or we should have made the threat of war years ago," I said. "And now we are paying for it." And he said, "Well, now you want to carry on, do you?" "Oh, yes," I said. "Same enemy." And I said, "I'm not going to duck the issue." "Oh, splendid," he said. Well, damn me, the next day he came up, the brigade commander was with him, Brigadier General. And we had half an hour's conversation, and they were probing me with questions about this, that and the other. So the brigadier said, "Well, now, what are you going to do?" I said, "I'm going down to the recruiting office and sign on."
What type of questions were they asking you?
Well, about various aspects of the war in Spain, you see.
About the calibre of the enemy?
Yeah. and their tactics and whatnot. And he said, no, he said, don't you do anything of the sort. Well, what can I do, I said. Well, he said, for a starter, I'm willing to give you an immediate commission. It was either in the Royal Welsh Fusiliers or the Welsh Regiment. And I said, well, that's extremely kind of you, I said, but I don't know that I would be capable of filling the bill. I said, I've seen something in the ex-servicemen who were ex-British Army soldiers and sailors who were fought with us in Spain, I said. And there's a great deal that I've got to learn. So I said, in any case, I said, I want to get on the guns. Because I said, I served through four engagements as an anti-tank gunner with Russian guns, 37 millimetres, that could also fire high explosive. And I said, guns are going to play a tremendous part in this war. So he said, well, I can't do anything for you there, he said, because you can't be commissioned in the Royal Artillery unless you go through your training, see. So I thought no more about it, and they asked me where I lived, and I told them, gave them my address. Next thing I knew now, I had a card from the War Office. Report to the appointments board in Cardiff on such and such a date. I went down, and I was examined by about 10 doctors. And I met the chief doctor then, and he said, Mr. Brewer, he said, no, you seem to have had a considerable amount of frontline service. And I said, yeah, a fair amount. Well, the only conclusion I can come to is, he said, that you're a very strong man. Thank you, I said. Now, I suppose you'll put me down A1. You'll disregard the fact that I got defective vision, that my toes are misformed. He said, it doesn't matter. So please put me down as A1. Oh, certainly, he said. The main point, he said, is your nervous system, which is absolutely sound, and your heart is sound, and your chest, well. So I duly reported, they didn't bother to interview me. That was a strange thing. No question, everybody else had to go before a panel of assessors and whatnot. Not me. And the doctors, there was a chap there doing the clerical work, and you'll hear from us in due course, Mr. Brewer. Next thing, I was called up to the Royal Artillery training place in Kimmel Park. They put into, after a week or two, put into the officer cadet squad, and ultimately found myself in Catterick, in Bolan Lines, being trained as an artillery officer. So there was no prejudice at all. I never met any. But the only time when I met it was among lower ranking officers, one or two later on. But I got my commission. I was a commissioned officer, and I didn't know precisely what I was entitled to as an officer. I knew what my duties were. Know very little about the privileges.
Going back to something you told me earlier, was that you knew an Aaron Bevan. Can you tell me how that came about, that you knew him?
Well, I was very active locally at the time in the Labour movement, in my spare time, and the young men of my age in this constituency were very perturbed about what was going on in Europe and in this country, and we came to the conclusion that our main preoccupation now was going to be the the Nazis and the fascists, and that something ought to be done to build up a movement in preparation for to meet anybody who tried the same dodge in this country. Well, I was quite young. I was quite young then, and I met an Irishman, and he invited me at a meeting, and he invited me to come over on the following Sunday now to his house in Tredegar. His mother was still alive, and his sister, Ari Anwyn, was keeping an eye on his mother, and she was married, Ari Anwyn was married to a baker. So I used to go over on a Sunday to tea, and have a chat with an Irene and Archie Lush, his constituency agent. And then after tea, an Irene would go over what the current situation was in Parliament in relation to international affairs. And then I learned the secret of his success. He used to, he'd never sit down and talk. He was always on his feet, walking around the room, stopping and making a few remarks, and he was sort of putting it all together in his mind. And this is where his success stemmed from, the fact, A, that he could think on his feet, and he was mentally very adroit. And the other thing was that he made marvellous use. He stammered. And he found out the words in the English language that he couldn't pronounce freely. So he would pause to search for a word which would give him no difficulty. And these little trenchant pauses were always followed by a devastating sentence. And it was a lesson to me in thinking on your feet, which is a very difficult thing to do, and to get the orderly march of ideas. And and this was now in the interval of my going to Ruskin. And my first summer, after my first year in Ruskin, I used to go along occasionally to tea in the Queen Square, at his house in Tredegar. And then, of course, we lost touch because I went off, as I told you, to the army and so on. But then I found myself in the year when he made that speech of his.
About going naked into the conference chamber.
Yeah. I was the chairman of the Constituency Labour Party. And and Irene became very impressed with me as a chairman. And I remember going to one meeting of the Constituency Association, and there was a young unilateralist there. And he's since become a county councillor, and he's been very consistent in the unilateral disarmament business. So he got up to question an Irene, see? And when he sat down, before I could say anything ordinary, one of the old brigade stood up and made some devastating and stupid remarks about this young man. And I was about to get up now to tell him that this young man was entitled to put his point of view, and in any case, that the man on my right was capable of meeting anybody in the world and putting his case. And the connection there was between the Member of Parliament and a loyal supporter of the Labour Party, and an Irene didn't need any protecting from him or anybody like him. But an Irene stopped me. He thought that I was going to stop the question, you see. And I said, no, you're wrong. I had no intention of doing that. But then he got up and he logically answered this young man. And then the following year, I think it was, I was on the council now. I was a senior councillor here, and I was secretary of the Trades Council. So I chaired the meeting when an Éireann came along, when he'd had to abandon that campaign because of illness. And he looked so damn fit and healthy, you know. And I was amazed. And so I got up now to introduce him to the audience, all the conventions, you know. And I said, no, I think we'll pause from the political battle. I said, we are grievously sorry to hear that you have had to abandon your campaign journeys. But I said, you have fought such a great battle that I think you're entitled to think about yourself and let others carry the burden for a while you see to your health. And of course it was a well kept secret that he had cancer, you see. And this was very roundly applauded by the local audience here, who they worshipped an Éireann. And he was moved by this, because it was the first time that anybody probably in years had made a personal statement of concern for him as a human being. And he thanked me for that, and the press were there in on this table underneath the stage, and he said, now you take note of that, he said. And then he told the audience, disregard these fellows, because his contempt for the press was profound. Pay no attention to these. He said, wherever I go, or wherever I open my mouth, there's one of these. They're ready to find a little chink that they can put their knives into. And if these local chaps had had their way, every damn correspondent would be thrown out. But there's a wonderful tradition here. We always went to the Tory candidates' meetings, and anybody who tried to interrupt him was told to keep quiet. The fathers of the village and of the Labour Party were there, see. And they would have fair play. No barracking, no nonsense. And they'd hear these people out, and then question time, and then they'd pile in. And it always rubbed the reality of their lives into the preconceptions of these would-be Conservative MPs. But everything was in good order. Now, Sir Rhys Brandon Williams was the parliamentary candidate one time, and it must have come as a shock to him to go into this schoolroom and see these chaps sitting around quietly, prepared to listen to him, and prepared to convince him that he was wrong. And it was a remarkable exercise in practical democracy.